Oh, good evening.
Good evening.
I realized that I was going pretty fast last week with this very dense little piece of teaching that has everything in it and nothing at all. So I thought I'd start by asking if you have questions about first the paramitas, because this is the Prajna Paramita, and so it means understanding what the paramitas are in the first place. that prajna is one of them, because the paramitas are what are, they say sometimes, the raft that carries us across. And so, although they're very simple and sound a lot like the Lojong that we just finished studying, which makes them even easier to understand, understanding them isn't the same as practicing them. And that, of course, is a lifetime proposition. But having some idea as we are studying the so-called Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, of which this is just a little kernel in the midst of a mass of teachings all saying the same thing, that practicing the Prajnaparamita is important to take in and connect with the others, the other five. So as you might remember, there are five of them, six of them, and generosity is the first one. Generosity is also the one that opens the mind, that giving itself is a selfless action. And so if we're able to even give, Buddha said, even a blade of grass, that itself is a practice that begins and opens the whole of the practice of the paramitas and of prajna itself. In generosity lie all the others. So, as I was saying with a friend the other day, it's sort of problematic, has been in my practice with my teacher, and somewhat for myself as well. It's a curious thing that in Arch Koban's tradition, and it's somewhat in Suzuki Roshi's tradition until after he died, people just took the teacher totally for granted. And it took a couple of very fierce women in Koban's tradition to realize that he was trying to pay a mortgage and raise two children and a wife, and that the dana was just about nowhere. And that was true of Suzuki Roshi also, that there's a kind of projection on a teacher sometimes that's more like a parent, and so the parent takes care of me, but I don't have to take care of the parent, of course not. So even in that sense, in the sense of our practice, in this intimate practice, that Dana Paramita is the thing that breaks open and helps the other ones come into fruition. And the next one is ethical practices, the precepts. So you see, it's all very, very vital, the real stuff. There are 16 precepts. It's about how to notice how we enact our lives as they are enacted through us, to be very aware of how we are as we are, keeping us awake. It sounds like don't be bad, be good, don't kill anything. And that's part of it, of course. We try very hard, and we know how impossible it is to fulfill any of them. And there's a positive side to sustain life, to always remember. And then the third one is that there is no killing life. That life lives. So you can feel how vital just those two paramitas are. And then it takes a lot of energy, a lot of vigor, and a lot of vitality, and it takes a lot of patience to maintain a practice in terms of the precepts and generosity. To really stay up for it. And maintain a meditation practice, which of course includes mindfulness. Again, staying awake and being present. Allowing oneself and giving oneself permission to be present. And the last one is prajna paramita. From which the mind is no hindrance. So as I say, this is a lifetime practice. And it's guidance for us. It's consolation for us. We don't need to hold ourselves up as wanting because we don't live up to this high ideal. It's not a high ideal. It's a very modest and humble one. Just to do our very best. So that's cool. That's what Avalokiteshvara was practicing. And then we talked about the five skandhas. Red Pine has a lot to say about the five skandhas. Everybody who writes about the Heart Sutra has a lot to say about the five skandhas. It's one of the ways that we learned how to say something about how things appear to us. The sort of magical illusion of the way things appear to us. The way our mind works is mostly with nouns. I think it's 70% of English is nouns, and something like 18% is verbs, and the rest are adjectives and et cetera. So you can see how we're always naming everything, always taking everything apart and giving it its own name. So although we start out saying, this is my body, then we say, yes, but this is my thumb. This is my hand. This is my fingers. This is my thumb. Dump, dump, dump. And if you're an anatomist, then you can go down to the electron microscopes and even smaller just to see what's there. What's there? It depends on what we want to call it. In any case, it's a very curious operation, you could say, that we experience things, we perceive them. Our body is a kind of receiving and sending mechanism, one that's not well understood yet. How it can be that between two people there's a tremendous amount of energy passing back and forth that now can be measured, but nobody quite knows what that is. I suspect these guys knew better than we do. So when we begin to analyze the way we perceive, take in, and then think about things, we have to see that our thinking, the kind of thinking that we do, actually gives us the world that we experience. Even though it starts out with form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness. You can go back the other way, and Buddha did. Consciousness then determines the and what kind of attitude we have, what kind of memories we have, what kind of conditioning we have, what sort of world we already live in. Conditions the way that we then feel about and understand what we think we know. So that's one way of understanding ourselves. This mysteriousness of how we have eyes and ears and nose and tongue and a body and a mind. They're actually finding more and more minds out there that are not human and not just in mammals. But there are very simple animals that actually figure things out in ways that nobody ever thought of before. There is a powerful energy running through all of us that we try to describe with the five skandhas. And what Avalokiteshvara perceived was that although it looks like it's a form with a lot of stuff going on, that it's what did Red Pine call it? The five pillars that support our awareness, which I think is a very easy way of understanding them, that it's an appearance of something going on that is a part of the whole boundlessness of the universe and eternal life. So understanding emptiness, the emptiness of the five skandhas, is crucial to understanding this Heart Sutra. And there are lots and lots of ways of seeing, but the kind of seeing that's being expressed here is about deep seeing, it says, perceived. deeply, the five skandhas are empty. So, obviously, our sitting practice is a way. So, understanding that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. You can read a lot of words about it and try to wrap your mind around it. I remember once trying to explain it to my husband, and we both ended up looking at each other like, what did I just say? Form is form, but none of it is all by itself. None of it is a disconnect from anything else. Not any one thing is separate. Not any one thing is going to last very long. Every little thing is going to turn into another little thing. And all little things are a part of every little thing. And that's what form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, really tries to express, so that when we begin to think about ourself as the five skandhas, if the five skandhas are empty, how does that work? Five skandhas don't differ from emptiness. The five skandhas are all totally, completely, universally connected to everything else. You and I and everyone, from the ISIS guys to the little kids in the nursery school, we're all in the soup together. So what Red Pine goes into is how the Sarvastivadins, the school before the Mahayana people came in. I hope you have a chance to read it. about how all dharmas are marked with emptiness, because Sarvastivadin said everything is empty except there are a few things that actually are real. And those things don't appear or disappear, aren't tainted or pure, don't increase or decrease. There is fundamental marks that the teachings of Buddha are absolutely, strictly real. And what the sutra is saying is all dharmas are empty. All the teachings of Buddha are empty. Meaning, not that they're meaningless, not that they're nothingness. Empty is a sort of disappointing word because it's not what it is pointing to exactly. But it means that it's not separate. You can't pluck something out and say, this one is special and this one isn't connected to everything else. This one is very particular because dot, dot, dot. And the sutra is saying there isn't any because. So the basic teaching of Buddha, impermanence and no self and suffering, even that you can't make a special little feature about it. That even that. And then the sutra goes on to extrapolate with the teachings of Buddha, and we can talk about that more. But basically, all dharmas are marked with emptiness, which means that, what does he say? All dharmas are false appearances. Which doesn't mean that we don't stub our toe when we hit a rock. You know, the way Dr. Johnson said when he heard Bishop Barclay, he said, "That's nonsense. That hurts." How can he say that? So studying the five skandhas is the way to understand how you can say that. Studying this so-called emptiness, which is not nothingness, but is the wholeness, is how we can begin to actually, in one case, one famous Zen case, stub our toe and become enlightened, become viscerally, feelingly, fully of the whole, as the whole. I brought a handout from another book, from Deshi Maru's book, Mushu Toku Mind. It's just a little bit where he talks about Zeko Kuchu Mu Shiki Mu Ju So Gyo Shiki Mu Gen Ni Bi Zetshin I Mu Shiki Shoko Mi Soko Bo. And this is the Japanese version, of course, so it's a little bit different. But he describes Ku and Mu, he says, are two different concepts. Ku means existence without noumenon, beyond form, absolute existence. That's Ku. Mu, on the other hand, the famous Mu, does a dog have Buddha nature? The answer is Mu. Mu, on the other hand, is the opposite of Ku, which is existence. So, it is non-existence, the extinction of existence. Mu shiki, there is no shiki, no form, no corporeal and relative existence defined by matter. Mu ju so gyo shiki, neither is there ju so gyo shiki. The five aggregates, the five skandhas, dissolve in ku. Existence, shiki, of which there are two kinds, the ego, the subjective existence, and the objective existence of the world that surrounds us. Shiki is a generic term, meaning the phenomenal world in its entirety, mind and body together. Through shiki, the union of matter and mind, the perceptions appear. Perceptions give rise to mental conceptions and the faculty of conceptualization, thinking. along with conceptualization, voluntary action arises, action and will. Gyo. Finally, Shiki, another Shiki, describes knowledge and memory and consciousness and the subconscious. So then it continues, Mu Gen Ni Bi Zed Shin. There are no six sense organs. Mu Shiki Sho Ko Mi Soku Ho. There are no six sense objects. Mu Gen Kai. There is not perception of the world. There is no world of the six perceptions, the field of six sensations, visions, hearing, smell, taste, touch. Also through Mu Gen Ni Bi Zed Shin Yi, through the absence of the six sense organs, the six perceptions do not appear. You can experience this during Zazen. But if there is a noise, your consciousness can be distracted. Your hearing wakes up. Your mental consciousness produces thoughts, memories, stirs up. This is how matter, through matter, sensation appears, giving rise to mental perceptions. Thank you. This has been my reaction to all the beautiful blooming things in my yard. I have a bush that's as big as this room, just about, and it has flowers all over it. And I've been just breathing it and breathing it, so it's stuck in here. Well, I think it's better for you to read this than for me to read it to you, because it's hard to hear. But let me share it with you, because it's another way of looking at the same thing with the words that we've been chanting for a long time, so that it...
So I find it a little confusing that I'm assuming it's a he mentioned the subjective and the objective. Isn't that kind of reinforcing this idea that there's a duality and that there's something out there that's permanent when he says objective existence?
It could be seen that way, but that isn't what he means.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as saying form is emptiness. You have to say that nirvana is samsara, mm-hmm. and samsara is nirvana. So our minds work, we call it the two truths, because our minds experience things as real, the way the Sarvastivadins would say, and yet with a deep understanding and sense sensitivity to the real, we can look more deeply and see that the real is constituted of that the real is a subjective experience of which we then objectify, mm-hmm. using our consciousness to name it and judge it and play with it in all kinds of ways. So I'm open to questions, of course.
So the other comment I wanted to make is that in the five skandhas, feeling is not what we generally interpret it to mean, which is an emotional quality.
Right,
it's
right.
Neutral, positive, or negative.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Because it sort of comes before all the consciousness, which is where all the emotional quality
yes.
comes in.
Yes. We're not even aware of feeling in the way that... In fact, does he call it feeling in his translation? His words are different. Sensation. Mm. Sensation and perception, memory and consciousness is how he spells it.
So he doesn't use impulses either, which would suggest some kind of volitional
yes.
action or will or something like that.
Yes, which it's not really. Mm. Not an impulse. It's based on what came before. It's a natural follow-up, you could say.
I still don't get who's being aware of all this. I'm sorry.
Well, yes. Who?
I just don't get it.
That's
who's aware?
Awareness is aware. As soon as you say who it is, it's something else.
Now you eat fish.
Does everybody know what a kiyosaku is? Yes, it's the stick that comes around behind you and you can ask for it. And they whack you here and here. And it feels wonderful. Because this is
right.
What gets
if
it.
Right.
If it's done right, yes. Yes, yes. We don't do it anymore. Coben did it in the very beginning, but... he began to realize that people were enjoying it for all the wrong reasons. Some people said, oh, hit me, I'm so bad. And other people who carried the stick said, ooh, this is my chance. Bam! I met a guy who actually bragged that he broke two of the sticks at Green Gulch in the early years. He was not a very nice man, actually. It kind of scared me, but it can go like that. But if it's done right, as you're sitting long, long sits, and this part especially gets very, very tense, and just a good whack there from the back, and the whole thing just goes back down to the belly again. It's such a relief, just like that. But it's scary because you're sitting in total silence and then you hear footsteps coming behind you. Oh my God. I gotta sit straighter. Oh, do I need to be hit? And then they'll hit the person next to you with it. So everybody jumps. It's a whole different kind of sesshin practice. But it is, in this sense, And this is interesting because as you sit, then if you notice some new thing, what happens to your mind? What happens to the five skandhas of you? And they're measuring those things now. They're measuring Vipassana students who have never sat before against ones who have sat long, and given them loud noises to react to and measured their brains. And the ones who have sat for long react to the loud noise or the surprise and then come right back and just go right on with the sitting. And the ones who are brand new react before they come back. They're trying to figure out what the noise was and what that was, and then it reminds them of something, and it just goes, the mind just goes making up story after story. So something like the Kyosaku is a kind of practice of bringing oneself back over and over again. One of the crutches, you could say.
I had another, maybe, I don't know if it's a question or an observation, but I don't like to forget that it relieved all suffering and distress. Like, let's not skip over that part.
Yes.
It's really promising.
Yes.
And I guess I always think of it as kind of laying down a burden, you know, putting down a burden when I hear that, that kind of relief that you have when you're like, oh, finally put that down, you know.
It's the burden of the self,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of trying to be something, someone, one, some particular,
mm-hmm.
rather than being whatever the moment requires. Yeah. Yeah. Because that's where the suffering comes from, is our attachment to our self image, our wish to be a permanent fixture in the world, when that's not the truth of it at all. And it is a burden. And we all carry it. We all do. And to cultivate insight into how we do that, what that is, and how it affects us, is a part of our life experience. So it doesn't just happen in Zazen. It's, we can study it wherever we go and really see how it works as we are carried and carry ourselves through the world. It's a long study. And surprising. You know, we have so many good ideas about who we are. And then we'll do something that is so totally off the wall and not me anymore. Think, well, where'd that come from? Carolyn?
Angie, what you're pointing to now is what I think of. That's the prajna paramita. That, that's the insight we have into the self, the not-self, and how that is in the world with others is a part of the wisdom piece.
Yes.
How the wisdom shows itself in a way.
In relationship.
In relationship.
Yes.
In our lives.
Yes.
To ourselves, with ourselves, and with others.
Exactly.
And we have those, aha, oh, we did that. Oh, Oh, I said that.
Yeah.
And realize that.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, it isn't so scary. And that's what it's saying, too. No fears exist. If you don't think you have to maintain a certain kind of way to be.
And it is the wisdom of the ages.
Yes.
Like you carry the big book of wisdom.
Yeah.
Or you have to carry that burden.
That's true. Wisdom. And that's why life is so hard. And practice is hard. That's a different burden. Yeah. Oh, it's after 8 o'clock.
I have one question.
Yes.
Why is ku has been translated as empty?
Well,
did you change it?
There are so many different ways that people have tried to... boundlessness, I think, is maybe... But even that's not right either, because it's bigger than that.
Is the translation come from Sanskrit or Chinese version?
I suppose it's from Sanskrit.
Shunyata.
Shunyata. Yeah.
Very confused.
Wait, right.
What do you think ku? I mean, ku has a several meaning. It can be empty,
mm-hmm.
or sky, or air.
Oh.
And then, for me, like based on all the discussion, maybe it's like air.
Space.
Yeah, there's a thing that's there, I just can't touch it, or doesn't stay.
Yes.
But it's there and it
That's
doesn't
it.
Disappear.
But what word is what word can we use for that?
I don't know.
I'm glad you brought that up. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It's like an empty cup.
Mm-hmm.
It holds everything. Potentially, it holds everything.
Something is there.
Something is there that can receive. Yeah. Thank you. Announcements?
I don't have any announcements.
Okay. Life goes on. Thank you. Let's do a minute.